All right, thanks. I'm going to give the overview of kind of the, you know, kind of the evidence base for MAT in criminal justice settings, and then we'll hear, you know, from Homer and Bruce about, you know, real city-level initiatives. My disclosures include NIH funding, Alkermes funding of a recent investigator-initiated trial. Alkermes is the sole manufacturer of Vivitrol, extended-release naltrexone, and we try and get free study drug whenever we're doing an NIH trial, and we've gotten that recently for other studies, Vivitrol and Suboxone. So, of course, opiates are a bigger problem than ever, prescription opiates, and then the kind of the recent uptick and expansion of heroin use. You know, we're reading today about the middle-aged, lower-income white people dying, and principally from alcohol and opiate-related stuff. So, you know, more and more it becomes kind of a national epidemic and problem in terms of number of people that need treatment that don't get it, and then deaths per year. And the basics of MMT, this is Australian kind of observational cohort data, just a snapshot of what you, why we like MMT. This is probably mostly methadone maintenance, although buprenorphine is also available in Australia. Looking at heroin users, untreated versus treated, you're getting better mortality in both younger, riskier age group, the people in their 20s, and older adults in their 30s if they're in MMT. This isn't a randomized trial. They're different populations. It's the basic kind of fact of life that we try and present, not so much to APHA, but, you know, when you're presenting to corrections, when you're presenting to skeptical providers, you really need to kind of start with the, it's really, you know, on drug, people doing better, off drug, don't get as good outcomes. It's very similar to other behavioral health conditions, very similar to other chronic diseases. And we don't do a great job in regular community drug treatment getting enough people on MAT with opiate use disorders or alcohol or tobacco use disorders, the other addictions that we have good medications for. And then we offer even less in criminal justice inside when people are incarcerated or in community corrections, including parole, probation, drug courts, other community supervision schemes. You'll get a little bit more rates of use because you're doing community treatment when someone's on parole, but you still don't get even to the levels that you get in non-criminal justice involved people. It's not really surprising historically why we don't do great MAT or evidence-based addiction care in jails and prisons, particularly for heroin disorders. You know, that's a bad thing. You need to be punished. The jail at your local county doesn't have the budget to think through kind of all the healthcare needs and doesn't have the motivation or kind of policy oomph to provide it. They're really there to kind of punish. And then stigma is a big thing that we should, I'm sure, talk about in all the presentations. Your typical correctional policymaker authority probably doesn't think much of methadone and in more modern times, buprenorphine as well. And then, as we saw, we're not doing enough of it in the community, so why would you expect adequate rates in inside? This is back to Australian data. Australia is awesome because they kind of have the big data thing down a little bit better than we do nationally, so you can link pharmacy with incarceration, with treatment, with mortality data. We know early on after release from prison or jail from international, including U.S. data, people start to die at higher HMAS rates in the first week out, in the first month out. That's the riskiest time. And then overall, their HMAS mortality is too high. And here, though, if they got OST, that was methadone or buprenorphine, pre-release in an Australian prison system, and then post-release, they continue it. In the community, they have a nicely lower mortality curve over time, including in the first 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks out. The basics of how these medicines work, why they work, is that you know, if people are compulsively using drugs to get a lot of dopamine release, at least initially, or kind of the memories in the ventral striatal system are all about drug use turning into cravings and compulsive use. You don't really listen to your executive center much. You really just want to go get more drugs in order to kind of drive more reward and the memory of reward. And the idea in treatment then is to kind of get your prefrontal cortex fired back up so you can make better decisions, choose healthy activities versus unhealthy activities. And so that's the whole task of drug treatment, how to kind of get back to the healthy brain from the addicted brain. And medications, particularly the opiate medications, work immediately, and they go into the brain and they do stuff, you know, chemically and neurotransmitter into neurotransmitter receptors, and they have beneficial effects, and it's the same as other behavioral health medications or other metabolic agents. They work because they're doing something, and we know about it from a neuroscientific basis, and they work relatively quickly, as opposed to residential or incarceration, where you're trying to remove someone from the offending agent, or kind of relearning healthy behaviors over time, the basics of behavioral therapy. These, you know, residential works when people are inside a facility, and generally when they leave, there's not a lasting tail, and you can't continue residential treatment if someone's going back to the community. And then behavioral therapy and relearning is going to take time as well. So one of the nice parts about these medications is they work quickly. We're probably all familiar with these curves, but naltrexone is a complete antagonist. It has no opiate effect. Naltrexone drugs then are blockers of the opiate system. If they're on board, they prevent the activity of illicit opiates, heroin and oxycodone, etc. And because they're antagonists and have no opiate properties, they're not controlled substances, gives them somewhat more ease of use in that they're not controls. Buprenorphine is the predominant form of MAT in the United States now. Can be prescribed by general practitioners or any MD or DO with a little bit of training and a DEAX number. It's a partial opiate agonist. It also sits on the receptor, binds very tightly, prevents the activity of heroin or oxycodone. But as the dose goes up, the effects, the opiate effects, including sedation and overdose, are limited, and so it's safer, and therefore was approved as a Schedule III controlled substance for office-based use. And then methadone is an actual opiate. It's a full opiate agonist, also long-acting, very good binder at the receptor. It outcompetes heroin and oxycodone. That's the basis for its treatment effect. It keeps you kind of level and not in and out of withdrawal, and then prevents you from getting high. It kind of blocks heroin if used at the right dose. But if we give you too much methadone, you can overdose, and so it's used much more carefully and in a much more controlled fashion in a opiate treatment program. With very few exceptions, the only way to get methadone for the treatment of an opiate addiction is in a licensed OTP or MTP, a methadone treatment program. Methadone, since its kind of invention in the 50s and 60s by the Dole, Nicewinder team at Rockefeller University in New York City, was always kind of seen as a criminal justice kind of treatment agent. And some of the earliest trials published in JAMA and New England Journal were about treating heroin addicts in the city jail system in New York and preventing kind of painful, disruptive withdrawal syndromes, and then trying to keep people in treatment and prevent reincarceration. And this is a nice look at what it took to get published in the New England Journal in 1969. It was like an N of 30 study. So would that we could go back in time to those days. This is more recent data. One thing that happens is if your city county isn't going to continue your methadone or do any kind of detox, you have to kick so-called forced withdrawal. And that's a horrible thing. It's very uncomfortable to come off methadone all of a sudden, as with any opiates, but maybe even worse with methadone as opposed to kicking heroin. And that's a typical experience for a community-maintained methadone person who's then suddenly arrested and incarcerated. What this team at Rhode Island, led by Jody Rich, was doing was just showing, okay, that's standard of care, and it's probably inadequate, so let's continue your methadone, as we'll hear we do in Rikers Island. See if you go back to treatment. And 100% of people that were able to continue their methadone in a randomized fashion during incarceration went back to treatment. So that's the model, and it's completely similar to other chronic diseases, to HIV, to severe persistent mental illness. Why would we stop the drug that's probably working just because you're incarcerated? Part of methadone's story is that because it was came to market, if you will, a long time ago, we don't have these kind of modern placebo-controlled or randomized trials. So NIDA then, I think, seeing a need to have more of it in the criminal justice system, was funding studies in the last like decade or so to really kind of remodel and reprove, if you will, the effectiveness of methadone. And so this is starting it in Maryland state prisons before you leave. Probably people were opiate abstinent at baseline, but they were heroin users prior to their incarceration. They're going to return mostly to the Baltimore area. And so this study put you back on methadone before you got out and then continued after you left. The kind of middle dose of treatment was to have a hot referral that is like, hey, there's a clinic for you when you leave. They know who you are. They're ready to treat you as soon as you get out. Versus really referral only, which is kind of like education and, hey, methadone's good. Why don't you go get some when you leave? And that group, you know, essentially was kind of a treatment as usual arm. They didn't do so well in terms of 12 months after release being in any kind of treatment, none of them. Going back to heroin use, two-thirds of them. And also heavy amount of cocaine use. That's the typical story. Incarcerate a active user, don't give them much treatment, they go back to using when they get out. And the methadone arm pre-release got you a better response in terms of people staying in treatment over the next 12 months and reducing opiate and cocaine use. And then naturalistic data will tell similar stories. This is a just looking at people in Birmingham. TASC. TASC is kind of like drug court for parolees. It's a kind of federal network. And so in Birmingham, they looked at the N here is a couple hundred people. So people in methadone were doing much better in terms of completing TASC and not relapsing. This is looking at the probability of relapse over so many days. And it goes quite a while out versus regular kind of heroin or opiate users who are not signing up for methadone and not doing as well over time, even though they all had similar criminal justice supervision and kind of motivation for completing the program. You know, a problem with methadone, though, is that it's limited to OTPs. MTPs, they tend to be not, like, heavily kind of promoted by the medical center. It's not like the hip surgery center, you know, with a nice glassy entrance and a Starbucks. It's, you know, it's they've been, you know, it's a network of for-profit or not-for-profit or kind of health system-based clinic programs, but they vary in terms of their attractiveness. You have to go every day. That's the basis of OTPs, it's directly observed therapy initially, although you can work up to more take-home privileges. We deal with, in real treatment, trying to recommend to people who have the problem, who need the treatment, and yet won't go. They've done it before, they don't want to go back to the clinic every day. They had to go through withdrawal at some point. It was painful and uncomfortable. There's all these myths that are not true, but yet are persistent. It rots your teeth. It rots your bones. Oh, look at that guy in methadone. He's got a cane, and he's nodding off on the bus. You know, none of that is actually an effect of methadone, but it is a, you know, common kind of PR problem throughout the treatment program. So although methadone is life-saving, cost-effective, I think in New York City we have, for instance, available slots. We're not at complete capacity, and yet we have, we think, way more opiate users who should be filling those slots, and yet we don't year to year. So there's some kind of gap between, you know, the need and the actual kind of perceived demand and then what we actually deliver. So Suboxone, in part because methadone is a little clunkier and because Suboxone or buprenorphine products are safer, back to that dose response curve, it was approved in the early 2000s for the U.S. market with this naloxone component added to the buprenorphine. That became Suboxone. At first that was the brand name for the tablet, now that's the brand name for the film. It was very successful, and so along with our opiate epidemic, we were able to expand treatment very nicely, although we heard from President Obama 2 weeks ago, we still don't do enough of it. We'd like to do more. We need more docs to prescribe it and more availability for underserved populations, and yet we have made some gains with buprenorphine. Any doctor that is completing a basic kind of 1 to 8 hour training can get their DEAX number. It is limited to MDs and DOs as prescribers, so the PA or the LPN is not yet able to prescribe this drug. And then the basics are the same as with methadone. You go on Suboxone on a basic dose and then you're rates of opiate-positive urines go down nicely. Not everybody does beautiful in community office-based Suboxone treatment, but it is a very effective agent, so if people are taking it and serious about treatment, it's relatively simple to get people, you know, into meaningful recovery and abstinence from illicit opiates. So how does it apply to the criminal justice system? This is a study that we did at Rikers Island, kind of 2006 through 2008, a brief study, but we compared it to what we did have available and we'll hear more about, which was methadone maintenance at arrest. If you're out of treatment and you're interested, that is an option in the New York City jail system. The buprenorphine group did a little bit better in terms of completing their buprenorphine treatment while incarcerated, and then had a substantially higher rate of continuing bup when they got out of jail. So that was, it didn't prove it was better than methadone. There were reasons that the methadone provided in this study could have been better, and it may have attracted a group of people that weren't in the end that interested in methadone, but rather were using the trial to access bup, and if they were then not randomized to bup, they weren't that interested in what the methadone arm was offering. But nonetheless, it showed it was kind of feasible to do. It was the early experience at Rikers with getting people onto buprenorphine, administering it in an observed way, unlike we do in community treatment where you take home your dose and take it by yourself. In the jail, it's a controlled substance, so you're doing directly observed dosing with the nurse. And that was kind of initial data from Rikers Island. We then tracked these, a bunch of those people from that trial came to our primary care office-based program at Bellevue Hospital, a large public hospital in New York, where we had buprenorphine for Medicaid and uninsured people. And they were able to do exactly the same. This is just comparing retention and treatment between people, sorry, this laser pointer is awful, between people that had come to the clinic from Rikers versus any other referral source, and they all did the same, meaning that once you're doing a kind of public sector opiate treatment program, you're kind of treating all the same people. Some are in and out of jail more often than others, but the referrals you're getting from the criminal justice system you could expect to do as well, and they're not more difficult or less successful than other patients. Other buprenorphine data has come from back to the Maryland group, the Friends Research Institute team. They also did a start your bup before you get out of Maryland prison. This is almost exactly kind of the protocol they were using in the methadone study I just showed. Very initial low doses. You got to kind of start slow. Start low, go slow when you're starting up a otherwise person that's abstinent at that point because of incarceration. Now you got to get them back on the methadone or buprenorphine. Some people won't tolerate that, so that is an issue. That's about 10% of people had to kind of quit when they started on, they didn't like it. And then diversion is an issue. There's more pressure inside to cheek the med, put it in your pocket, fake out the nurse, and then have this buprenorphine to give out to your friends later when you're back in your dorm or cell block. And that's, you know, we have to acknowledge that's an issue, and that's a reason that criminal justice authorities aren't too thrilled about more controlled substances, including buprenorphine, in the facility. And this was back with the Rhode Island group. It was just looking at people in a cohort. They were able to get on bup before they left first. People who weren't able to get on it and were told to go get it when they got out, if you're able to get it on it on board before release, they had a higher response in terms of people staying on treatment. Small numbers, but kind of a similar experience to what we've learned from methadone. And then there's been a series of studies with buprenorphine and naltrexone in Connecticut prisons led by Sandy Springer, focused on HIV-positive clients. And really the focus here is not the opiate treatment, but improving HIV outcomes. And this is a buprenorphine cohort, not a randomized trial, but those that were able to, those that chose to start up bup and continue it pre and post release had relatively better HIV outcomes down the line in terms of viral suppression and CD4. So there's a lot of pros to bup. It's, we'll talk about the logistics of starting up these programs and the licensing and all that kind of stuff. Buprenorphine can be, once you have a trained provider and your pharmacy has it in stock, that is, if you're a correctional institution, you can start prescribing buprenorphine. We still struggle to have enough providers that want to focus on public sector, uninsured, criminal justice-involved populations in the community. So that's the other shoe to drop. If you started up a bup program in your jail, who's going to treat all these people when they get out, and you have to kind of think that through. It's still relatively expensive, although we have generic forms of buprenorphine now, the buprenorphine tablet. Those are still priced pretty high in terms of out-of-pocket expenses. I was just presenting in Utah, which is not a Medicaid expansion state, and from the land of milk and honey in New York, where it's now just routine to, one, get Medicaid. Almost everybody's eligible now if they're otherwise poor or unemployed, most of this population. And Suboxone products, buprenorphine, are available on Medicaid formulary, so it's a slam dunk. But in a state where that's not happening, it's still a real struggle to finance the medication costs. And people that are trying to pay out of pocket just don't, that doesn't last very long, and they don't continue on treatment. So finally, there's less data, but perhaps emerging quality data regarding Vivitrol. Vivitrol is a different approach. It's for relapse prevention. It's a complete antagonist. So you're only offering it to people that are not interested in agonists or already or able to or planning on a detox, and then want kind of vaccination during their recovery period against returning to opiate use. It's nice because it's an extended release version of naltrexone. We already know a lot about naltrexone because it's been an oral product on the market for decades for alcohol and opiate disorders. And compared to drug-free treatment as usual, including counseling, it tends to prevent relapse over time. And the pivotal study is displayed there, which was done in Russia. Not completely uncontroversially. Russia doesn't have methadone or buprenorphine, and it's cheap. So it was a good place for the company to do the study, but then they got a lot of shtick for it because they, you know, may have kind of cherry-picked a country where their product would work, but we're not comparing it to an agonist-based standard of care. We've looked at Vivitrol in community corrections, people on parole, probation, or in and out of jail. This was a 5-site randomized trial that is not in the literature yet, but we're starting to present it at meetings and have final data now. We do expect to publish it soon. We randomized over 300 people to treatment as usual versus Vivitrol. Again, they were absent at baseline. They had a history of opiate dependence, all criminal justice involved, but they were not planning on bupre or methadone, and their goal was kind of drug-free opiate abstinence. And over time, people randomized to Vivitrol did better in terms of relapse-free survival. And tracking them for 18 months, they had fewer overdoses. We think this was important because there's some controversy with Vivitrol in the treatment provider community that Vivitrol, it'll be so like boring to be blocked that people will just use a ton of heroin to get high anyway. They'll try and overcome the naltrexone blockade. Or they'll just drop out of treatment, and then they'll resume use, and then they'll overdose, because once they drop out of treatment, their tolerance is, you know, zero. It's kind of like walking out of a rehab or detox, which is otherwise a dangerous time in terms of overdose. But we didn't see any signal that there were some more overdoses, including during treatment and then following people for 12 months after they stopped Vivitrol, and everybody stopped Vivitrol after 6 months in this study. And then we've done a small jail study. Sorry, I'll come right back to your question. A small jail study at Rikers, where everyone's sober at baseline and about to leave. They're not on methadone or buprenorphine. They get a shot of Vivitrol, and then they are able to get one more shot at week 4. And the Vivitrol arm is on the left, and the treatment as usual is on the right. And treatment as usual just shows kind of what happens to heroin users after arrest in New York City. They go back to using for the most part, or we lose track of them, or they get reincarcerated. Very few people, although they all kind of intend to stay sober at baseline, when you do an interview and talk to these people about what's going to happen to them when they leave, they for the most part go back to using, and that's normal. They weren't looking for treatment. They were using at arrest. They didn't ask to be arrested or detoxed. So it makes sense that they would go back to using. And we saw a nice preventative effect of, in terms of relapse rates in the Vivitrol arm. This study has been published recently in Addiction. So there's kind of 3 medication choices now. And one is for relapse prevention. That's Vivitrol. The other two are for the maintenance of opiate dependence. That's methadone and buprenorphine. So it really comes down to what's kind of the local lay of the land, what are community standards, what is available, what's the Medicaid policy, what does the patient want, what providers are available, and you can kind of go from there. But any of these three are better than no drug treatment for heroin users or other opiate patients. And I think I can stop there. So we had one question. Yes. Yeah, TAU in both these studies, in this one and that one, is whatever you want to go get, including buprenorphine or methadone, if you change your mind. Because you have to say, to get into these studies, like, that's not my intent. We're not trying to prevent people from getting the agonists. Their goal, self-reported, is kind of not to use those medications. But they could then, after randomization, go access those medications. Yeah, there's different medication costs. So the public price of Vivitrol, that is, say you're a federal, city, state agency, is around $500 a shot. That's about half off the retail price. If you just try and buy it as a patient at drugs.com, it's like $1,000, $1,200 a shot. But say the jail's buying it, they have to have a medical visit, you know, probably before the shot, and then when the shot's given. Could be given by a nurse, like a vaccine. You got to store it in a fridge, but you got to buy the drug, and that's $500. To maintain people on Suboxone or buprenorphine products, it's probably still about $1 a milligram. People's maintenance dose is, you know, 12 to 24 milligrams. This is out of pocket. So if you were trying to buy that at Walgreens, it could also be $300, $400, or $500 a month. But you're going to have Medicaid in the community, and therefore the patient level cost is zero or a $10 copay. When the Rikers Island is buying buprenorphine, I'm not sure what price you're getting, but it's going to be, you know, I don't know, $5 to $10 a day probably in pharmacy costs. Methadone is essentially free. It's a you know, long-standing generic medication. The daily medication cost there is probably a nickel, and then you're talking about the program costs because there's more regs. That doesn't make as much of a difference in the jail. You do have to go get your methadone every day. You have to do that also with buprenorphine. With Vivitrol, you don't have that issue. It's one shot, and then you're done. So you have to kind of staff, as we'll talk about, the medication line. In the community, you have to be in an OTP, so the OTP implies, you know, real estate overhead, and you have to have this many nurses and one or two docs and this many counselors, so there's kind of ratios of staffing that have to be done. And the person's going to come in and out every day. So there's that kind of program cost. Buprenorphine in the community could be delivered in a kind of general practice setting where it's a primary care clinic, and so you're basically saying for each refill visit, it's a primary care visit, you know, at whatever, $200, $300 a pop, whatever the market rate of that is. And same for Vivitrol. If you narrowed it down to once a month getting a shot for a stable person, it would just be a regular medication visit, and maybe it wouldn't be a doctor visit. Maybe you could just have an injection visit once a month. But it tends to be built out, particularly for criminal justice populations, into specialty treatment paradigms where there's a lot of more than just a simple primary care visit. There's more counseling built into it. So that would be typically how most, like, parolees would get Vivitrol or bup or methadone. It would be part of kind of a specialty treatment package. Okay, thank you. Yes?
What is the gray and the white boxes and the pink boxes?
Yeah, the light gray was lost to follow-up, like I just don't know what happened to you, and the dark gray was reincarcerated, usually back at Rikers in this New York City study.
Thank you.